Okay, thank you. Thanks. I'm overprepared again, so I'm going to go fast. We're going to look at pantheism today a little bit and do some other things. But first, I want to kind of summarize a little bit. And this is, I've never given this talk before. And if I were in my church, I wouldn't give this talk because they need a different talk. Because I go to a charismatic church. But I am going to a charismatic evangelical church. So bear with me. But and the reason I'm doing this is because if you look at the data about spirituality and college students, what you'll find is the following. That college students who are Christian become less Christian when they go to college. College students as a whole, including those children, become more spiritual. Okay, so how can that be? And I'm going to suggest from the start that it's because we have forgotten in our gospel that we and Jesus are not of this world. And I'm going to share with you some things. And the scriptures were really just to prepare us, the ones that are flashing up, but we'll stop them now. They were just to prepare us to contemplate the scriptures that we don't contemplate too much, like when the angel tells Daniel that he was held up for 21 days to answering his prayer, and the angel that let Peter go, and the earthquake that happened when Paul and Silas were in jail. So I just want to start with a little recap that Christianity is compatible with the three certain particular principles of the three worldviews, because none of those worldviews could stand unless they had some truth in them. So regarding naturalism, which is really the confrontation to the authority of God, regarding naturalism, a Christian certainly believes in the scientific method and that we're called to understand the natural world, and that natural world, because it's composed of the spiritual world, does reveal to us the mind of God. And that to understand the natural world is to actually improve on human conditions. So we have medicines and technology and things. The secular humanist, which is the challenge to Jesus as a perfect man and God, and a challenge to the idea that we need redemption, that there was a fall, believe actually in the second commandment of Christ. They believe we should love our neighbor as we love ourselves. But they do not believe in the first commandment of Christ. And that's the problem, of course. And I believe that Jesus put those two in the order that he put them in, because we cannot do the second one unless we have done the first one, which is to love the Lord, as Dallas has told us for a couple of days, with all our heart, our mind, our soul, and our strength. Pantheism is a confrontation to the Holy Spirit. The idea in pantheism is that there's just this wonderful divine spirit around here, and it's just sort of free-floating. And our goal in our spiritual discipline as a pantheist was always to capture that spirit and to channel it for our own power. Now, we thought we would use that power for good, but that's what we were doing. So I was a pantheist. I had played around with a lot of things in my life, and largely at the homes of people like engineers. Now, interestingly, there's a lot of scientists who are not Christian but pantheist. They're a little quirky, and they really are playing. You go to their homes, and there would be these kind of parties, and people would, like me, you know, intellectuals, progressive intellectuals would go. And we would bend spoons, and some people in the backyard would walk on coals. Okay, the mind over matter idea. And this goes on, at least in Los Angeles. Where Dallas and I live, this is an activity. Okay, so as a child even, I think I always knew there was a spiritual reality. I think I always had that sense, and I think maybe it was because I was a very sick child, and that's a whole other story. But I never experienced that in church. The closest I got to a spiritual experience in church is I used to weep as a child through the Good Friday service because everything was draped in black, and I was aware that we were at the funeral of a very important God, Jesus. So, but I was also clear from my education, if you can use that word for it, that Christianity was not the place where a progressive would go for spiritual action. Okay? Not only that, but if you sort of add to that what I told you yesterday, that in my education, I had been told that Christianity was the root of all oppression in the world, and that was why the West, through missionaries, had come to conquer people, to colonize the world. And secondly, that it oppressed both the poor and women. And thirdly, it was narrow and moralistic. And moralistic and morality and moral were bad terms. Okay? They were, you know, politically incorrect terms at the best. So we wanted, those of us who were involved in all of this, and I started at the University of Texas my first week in graduate school because my roommate was doing transcendental meditation. And she said, "You want to come with me?" Oh, sure. There, off I went. Well, we believed that to be spiritual meant that we were going to be good without a lot of rules. We wanted this power. Now, this, I think, is a really interesting point. We never articulated this, but I believe that what we wanted somehow is a kind, we wanted to own some kind of power that no one could take away from us. Okay? That's spiritual power. That's also true in Christianity, right? And we thought that if we had it, we would use it for good, but mostly we were using it for fun. Okay, we weren't really using it for good. We were going to become enlightened beings. That was the goal of our work, our disciplines. And our disciplines were to meditate on giving up desire, but of course we didn't really give up desire. We just changed our desires. And in fact, the desire to give up a desire is a desire. Okay, I understand that the word desire comes from of the Father, so... That's the biggest thing for me originally was to line up my desire, get my heart, get our heart purified so that our desire is clean and good and pure and what God desires for us and what plan he has for our life. And then he can work by giving us the desires of our heart. He can trust us with the desires of our heart. When I said to others, and I know that everybody in this room has had this said to them, so I'm going to translate it for you. When I said to other people, well, when they would talk to me about religion or anything, I would say, well, I'm spiritual, but not religious. Okay, here's the translation. When someone says that to you, this is what's in their mind. I'm actually better than you spiritually, okay? Because I don't need any rules or any sort of guidelines to guide my spiritual quest or my spiritual power. And I believed that ultimately I would have more power than you. Okay, that was what was in my mind when I said I'm spiritual and not religious. That I wouldn't tell you, right? So we also had methods for decreasing our desire, supposedly, and increasing our spiritual power. And they were meditation, concentration on things, that's how you bent spoons, mind over matter kinds of things, walking on coals, and so forth. Now, you'll notice that this spiritual power in pantheism is generally for individual accomplishment. This is really important. Never was I freer to be more self-centered or individualistic than I was in the pantheistic movement. It's all about me. And most of the people in it are young, healthy, and wealthy. You don't really have a lot of poor people coming to transcendental meditation classes. So it's not that we didn't think that we were doing good. I mean, for those of you who get massages, most of our masseuses have been trained in this. They're channeling energy on our bodies. That's what they think they're doing. Now, I met a young woman who was talking about this, and she really sincerely wants to help people, I mean, I have to say this. She really wants to help people. She wants to be a healer. That's what she wants to be. And she believes through this energy, and I believe energy exists and things like that, she believes that she'll be able to heal people. And one time, because I knew from a friend of mine that this woman was very opposed to Christianity, I said to her, wow, that's really interesting because, you know, when Jesus walked the earth, he had so much healing power, healing energy, that he could actually heal people miles away from him just by a word. And she looked at me and said, wow, that's amazing. Now, there's not a whole lot of pantheistic organizations that serve the poor. For example, the Calcutta government gave Mother Teresa as her first place an old Hindu temple when they built a new Hindu temple. That's actually the home for the dying. And the Hindus, and the Hindu priests in particular, organized against her in the beginning. And they went to the city and they said, you can't give this woman this building. She's not a Hindu. And the government said to the Marxist government said to them, if you will do what she's doing for the poor, we'll give you the building back. And then they left her alone. Now, fortunately, even though what I believe is that our churches are not teaching the spiritual aspects of Christianity, the more metaphysical, mystical, whatever you want to call it, miraculous parts of Christianity. If we're teaching it, we're not believing it. But you see this symbol? How many of you have seen this symbol? Okay. Only a couple people? Okay. You will see it now that you've seen it, I believe. It is all over the back of pickup trucks in Los Angeles. And for a long time, I didn't actually understand what it was. I kept looking at this, and I kept thinking, what does that mean? Can you throw up the black one? I'm sorry. Until I found a truck that had both of them on it. This is what it means. Not of this world, a saying of Jesus. And it is the actual branding symbol for a company called C28, which is a Christian clothing company for teenagers. You actually occasionally see it in the mall, but you know it's online. You can look it up. Now, what are these kids saying? This is our teenage Christians' attack on pantheism. That's what they're doing. And on a powerless Western church. Now, here's what Charles Kraft, a missiologist, says about our church. He was a missionary to Nigeria. Though the Nigerian church leaders decided that a primary strategy would be to focus on God's conquest of spirits through Christ, I was in no position to assist them. I tried to believe in the reality of evil spirits, but I was just plain ignorant in this area. They learned not to expect power, except in the material realm, where we had brought Western medicine, schools, agriculture, and even a Western approach to Christianity, all in the name of Jesus. The Nigerians knew that whatever power Christianity brought wasn't adequate to deal with things such as tragedy, infertility, relational backgrounds, and troublesome weather. Westernized Christianity didn't meet many of their deepest spiritual needs. We did pray, of course, calmly for ordinary things and fervently when things got bad. But Western secular techniques were our first choice. God was our last resort. Without meaning to, we taught our African converts that the Christian God works only through Western cultural ways, though soon they learned that our Western cultural ways couldn't handle their needs. I believe that's what we're doing. And there are a whole group of kids in colleges and even in high schools who are doing this. They're saying, hey, to their friends, hey, you think you're spiritual? Look at Jesus. He told us we're not even in this world. We're not even of this world. You know, that's how spiritual we are. They're sort of taking up for Jesus. They're sort of expressing that Jesus performed the extraordinary miracles. Now, Jesus never called these miracles or mystical or supernatural and certainly not metaphysical. It was reality for Jesus. It was reality because he had brought to earth the kingdom of God. Now, we never take seriously these scriptures like that we are seated on high now in heavenly places. We're not waiting to go to heaven to sit next to Jesus. According to the scriptures, according to Paul, we are seated in heavenly places now. I believe what we see with the youth, and some of these youth, if you're around these groups very long, you will find that some of these youth actually believe they'll probably be martyred. I'm talking about kids in the United States. And I believe that part of what we're seeing is what Joel talks about, the outpouring of God's Spirit. And it shall come to pass afterward that I will pour out my Spirit on all flesh. Your sons and daughters shall prophesy. Your old men shall dream dreams, and your young men shall see visions. Even on the male and female servants in those days, I will pour out my Spirit. I want to take one example that was on the, it was Acts 16. I want to go to Acts 16. You know the story. It's the servant woman who's being used. She has some owners who are using her because she's prophetic. She starts following Paul around. And she says, as she follows them around, "These men are servants of the Most High God who proclaim to you the way of salvation." She's telling the truth, actually, right? But God, Paul, in his spirit is upset. It's annoyed. Why? Because she's of another spirit. She has actually divined the truth, but from a different spirit, and he casts that spirit out. You'll remember that he then gets put in jail. There's an earthquake that causes him to be released. This is an example of what I was trying to share yesterday, a better example of what I was trying to share yesterday, that a spiritual discernment cannot be done on surface features. You can't look at, okay, is she telling the truth or not telling the truth, and decide whether or not this woman has demonic things going on, right? Well, I had played around with these things for a long time, and because I had played around with them for a long time, I needed deliverance. And most of my deliverance came within 3 weeks of my giving my life to the Lord. They came in experiences that I wouldn't even tell anybody about. For 9 months, I never told anybody about a couple of experiences until I was standing in a little monastery that's charismatic monastery, or it used to be, and I picked up this little brochure called Baptism in the Holy Spirit. Now, I'd never heard of that. I didn't know what it was. So I just picked up this little booklet. And I opened it. I remember to page 9. The booklet was probably not more than 15 pages long. And on page 9, my eyes went straight to a paragraph that said, "Sometimes people experience this like electrocution." Now, that's what had happened to me. I'd gotten up one morning. I was on my way to the bathroom, I thought. I was thrown back in the bed. And I began to feel like I'm being electrocuted. And it was very slow. It started at the top of my head and just begins to go down, down, down. I could feel it as it would go through my fingers, everything. Now, at first, I thought I was being electrocuted. I thought, you know, the plug behind the bed has hit the, you know, I'm like thinking. So, but that wasn't what happened. Because when I got up, I felt clean. I felt clean. That's all I could have told you then. I felt clean. So I began to understand that there were things going on in me. When I saw that 9 months later, I finally had someone to talk to. Now, it's not that for 9 months I'm not talking to Christians. It's that the Christianity I'm hearing doesn't have anything to do with the demonic releases I needed. Now, sadly, we have a whole generation of kids that are going to need deliverance. Because they're doing the same thing. They're playing the Ouija board at bet. I mean, that'd be the lowest thing they would do. You know, they're doing all of these really bizarre things like I was doing. I know this is not in our theology, but okay, here it goes. I had experiences with demons after I came to Christ. And my last one was on the way home from Mother Teresa's. Now, I knew by then what to do. I knew what was going on. I knew what to do. I knew that if I could just get the name Jesus out, it would be over. That's all you have to do, really. You have to call on Jesus. But these are the kinds of things that we don't really teach, and we don't deal with them in our church. We're not really operating on the whole gospel. And the students who are coming through becoming spiritual and not religious, it's become such a thing that you know that it's in the culture when it's in Target, right? I mean, I always say, if Target doesn't sell it, you don't need it. But now I have to say, Target sells some things you shouldn't have, like statues of Buddha. Target sells statues of Buddha for your garden, and it sells, you know, little yoga mats and all sorts of things. So you can see that it's completely in the culture, but we as a Christian church, I think, haven't awakened to it. Now, I'm not saying that seeking signs and wonders is a goal of Christianity. And I would point out pretty quickly that signs and wonders, like I've sort of shared with you already, happen in both sides of the spirit world, in both good and evil. So that's not going to be a really great sign. How many of you know about Lakeland, Florida? Does anybody know about Lakeland, Florida? Does anybody know? See, some of you do know. Now I need the picture. There's a man, a young man, he's in his late 20s, named Todd Bentley. This man, see the tattoos? This guy grew up in generations in trailer parks, okay? He was a drug addict. He was an alcoholic. And the Lord radically saved him. Radically saved him. And he, I think maybe for 3 years, he stayed sort of hidden and had these different experiences with the Lord. And now he's preaching. And a few months ago, he was invited to preach in a church in Lakeland, Florida. And he went there, and he started preaching, and people started getting healed. So they moved the church out to, I think it was a stadium, wasn't it? I'm looking for somebody who knew that. A convention center, something like that, a big gathering. So people all over the world are going to this. Now, he doesn't look like a preacher. But the people who go to him look like you and I, actually. And there's these records of just tons of people being healed. There's even 3 reports of people being raised from the dead. And people keep going. Now, he's still in Lakeland, Florida. He was supposed to be there for 2 nights, but it's been probably 2 months now. And you can actually find it on God TV. You can watch it in the evenings. I haven't watched it yet, but. So I always tell the Presbyterians like us that we need the Pentecostals. And the Pentecostals, I tell them, need the Presbyterians, right? And the Protestants need the Catholics, and the Catholics need the Protestants. One of the reasons for my writing that the book. Now, I understand, I go to a church where strange things happen, and sometimes. And there's a pastor from Redlands who was giving a talk one day, whose church is very similar. He has a church where there's a lot of prophetic things that go on. And he said, look, this totally freed me because, you know, I'm always nervous in my church. Who's going to, like, act out? This totally freed me. He said, look, 1/3 of what you see are people who need attention. 1/3 of what you see is demonic. And that's where, in our church anyway, there's a group of elders who have the spirit of discernment, and they take the people who are demonically acting out to another room for deliverance. And 1/3 of it is God. Now, the problem is, if you can't deal with the first 2/3, you may not ever get to the bottom third, the one that's from God, the one that's actually healing people. The one, Jesus, who cast out demons, that third is not may not happen. Okay. When I got to writing the book, I wanted to tell the story of Bablu. Bablu is a baby I worked with. And lovely little kid. When I got there, as the French woman said, he looked like a baby bird that had fallen out of his nest. He was supposedly 3 months old. And he had contracted an intestinal virus immediately. He looked like a newborn, except that his skin was all wrinkled up, you know, from malnutrition. And they were just trying to keep him alive by keeping him hydrated, because there really isn't any medicine for these viruses that constantly sort of mutate. And when Bablu, one day when Bablu really, he was always kind of on the edge, but one day I walked into Calcutta at over 100 degrees, and I saw him wrapped in a blanket, and I knew something was really dreadfully wrong. When I raced to his bassinet, it looked like he had died. But then I touched him, and I saw that he wasn't dead. So there was a sister there who had been trained in nursing, and held him while she threaded a little IV in his arm. Okay, and he stayed there all during that day, and I stayed the whole day. We were only supposed to stay till 1, but the sister said I could stay, and so I stayed there in a crib that actually where the side lays down, and an adult can actually sit in the crib with this child. And he was in this crib, and at night, about 6 o'clock at night, the mother house has adoration. It's a silent prayer in front of the Eucharist. And I wanted to go and pray for him. So it was about 6 o'clock, and I was thinking, okay, I'm going to go down to the mother house now. And all of a sudden, Bablu wakes up. You know, he's had a whole day of IV treatments. He's getting kind of excited. And I feel like he, like, wants to play now. You know, he wants some sort of attention. So I feel in my spirit that the Lord says to me, adore me through him, which is interesting, because that's what Mother Teresa and missionaries believe about all the people they tend, is that it's Jesus in the distressing disguise of the poor. So I stayed there, and about 7, I'm about asleep, he's about asleep, and one of the sisters taps me on the shoulders and says, do you want to come to our adoration? We're going to pray for Bablu. And the sister in charge said, you could come. Now, we were never supposed to worship at the other places. So I was delighted, and I went, and we worshiped and prayed for him. And then I went home, and the next day I came back, and Bablu was like he had never been sick. And all of a sudden, Bablu just started eating like crazy. Well, that day, I began to walk Bablu around. And as I walked around him, he was actually in this crib that faced 3 windows. And over each of the windows was a different picture of Jesus. On the left was a beautiful picture, probably left over from the British because Jesus was kind of blonde, of Jesus with the little children, right? All colorful and everything, all these children running up to Jesus. And on the right was a picture, an iconic picture, also very colorful, something like what you get in Christmas cards where Mary's holding Jesus and it's sort of made like a stained glass window in a way. And in the middle picture was a picture that, even though I had been around Catholics now a lot, it always kind of shocked me. And this is a picture of Jesus, a realistic painting, all in browns and golds, very dull looking in terms of color. And Jesus is holding his dark red heart outside his body, and it's dripping with blood, and it's on fire, and there's a cross in it and a crown of thorns around it. It's called the Sacred Heart of Jesus, which I found out later was the Missionaries of Charity had a special devotion to the Sacred Heart of Jesus, and Mother Teresa died on the Sacred Heart of Jesus Friday. So as I'm walking this little baby around, he starts to search these pictures above the window. And he focuses on the Sacred Heart of Jesus. And when he sees it, he starts kicking and waving his arms, which was kind of unusual for Bablu, because I was always trying to get him to be a little more exaggerated in his personality than he was. He wasn't very much like that. So I thought, oh, you know, just a coincidence. So maybe gas or something. So I walked him around again. I tried to kind of confuse him. And sure enough, I go back to the picture, same picture, same response. So I didn't tell the sisters right away because I didn't want to, you know, I wanted to be sure. I'm a scientist. So I had to do my number of trials. So I do it, went it several times, and it always happened. It always happened. So finally I told Sister Delphinus, who got very excited because she had read the lives of the saints and determined that a lot of saints actually have this experience. We'll remember that Saint Francis of Assisi was converted by a cross. Well, I wanted to write that in my book because, and then toward the end, I mean, he didn't lose this enthusiasm for the picture. It was close to when I was going home, and one day I was standing there just letting him look at this picture and do his little thing, and all of a sudden he started to coo at this picture. He just cooed and cooed and cooed, these long sounds. But after that night, Bablu never had another problem eating. Bablu began to gain weight, and when I went home, Bablu went home 2 days later. Now, I know that was a miracle. I have no idea what happened between Bablu and that picture. I don't know. But it was something happened between Bablu and Jesus that maybe he'll never know. Probably he'll never know. I mean, he was only 3 months, 4 months old by then. But what was it, what is it that wanted me to not write that story? You know, when I turned in the page proofs the other day, the editor asked me, how does it feel? And I said, well, I'm a thinking type, so I can't tell you that. But what I can tell you is something's going on. And it doesn't feel that great to me. I said, you know, the last time I read this was last night before I drove up here. And for some reason, last night I read it like my colleagues will read it. You know, it's like you're all out there now. It's like, this woman is really nutty. Maybe that's what you'll say today after this talk. But, you know, as long as I'm already out there. But I think this is a problem. I personally believe that we are losing teenage kids, teenage Christians, to pantheism because we haven't dealt with the power of Christianity, the full power of Christianity. And I believe it's because of the Greeks. Okay, now after all that intellectual discussion, I know it's after 12, and I'm just anticipating that Stan's going to get up here and say, stop. Oh, it's Kelly now. Oh, well, you wouldn't have done that as much, would you? Okay, I will say one other thing. I really believe that Daniel's prediction about the Prince of Greece coming and Tertullian's warning, what does Jerusalem have to do with Athens, is the reason that we're this way. It's the reason that theology in the Western culture can't even deal with miracles. They have so many excuses, so many reasons that the miracles were just sort of mythological, they didn't really exist, and I believe that's because of what Daniel was warned, that after the prince of Persia, who had kept the angel from getting to him for 21 days, after the prince of Persia, there would be a prince of Greece. And I believe that that wisdom that came into the university got rid of all the mystics. The mystics were sent home to the monasteries. The mystics in the Catholic Church and the mystics in the Protestant Church still exist. T.D. Jakes says about the charismatic church, he said, you know what the difference between a Pentecostal and a charismatic is? Money. If you've got money, you're charismatic. If you don't, you're Pentecostal. Okay. I read one more quote from Chuck Kraft. It's interesting and discouraging to note that even though we are Christians, our basic assumptions are usually more like those of non-Christian Westerners around us than we'd like to admit. We have, as Christians, made certain modifications. That's what I was going to do in my book. But even though there is a wide discrepancy between the teachings of Scripture and common Western assumptions, we often find ourselves more Western than scriptural. This tension is especially acute if we seek to be more open in the area of spiritual power. okay, after all that little intellectualizing, I would say that I will end with the last words Mother Teresa gave me. The last time I saw her, she walked out. I was on a bench. Well, last time I saw her to really talk to her, and getting some materials to take back to the place where I was working. I'd been sent back for some materials. And she comes out of the little office, and she starts doing this to me the second she saw me. Now, Mother Teresa probably never even knew my name. She knew I was from the United States. That's all she knew. She walked straight up to me, and I was sitting on this bench, and she was standing, and we were eye to eye. That's how short she was. And she looks me straight in the eye, and she says to me, "You fall more in love with Jesus every day." And I said, "What would you say to Mother Teresa?" I said, "Yes, ma'am." Before I even knew what she had said to me, I said, "Yes, ma'am." Because it was that powerful. What she said to me was a prophetic word for my life, because I do have trouble doing this. You know, I love to be in the scriptures with my mind and everything, but really it's like Dallas is saying, it's the heart where our will comes out. It's the heart that should be controlling our mind and granting us access to the mind of Christ. It's not anything else. So I'll leave you with that. And then I'm going to actually, I've staged a question. I'll just admit, I have to come clean here. And do you mind if I just keep doing this? I mean, just keep, the question I've been asked several times last night and this morning is this question. What does it look like for you to give a lecture that actually has, that brings in Judeo-Christian thought into just your secular classroom? So can I do a little demonstration? I mean, is that okay with people? And then I'm going to be here, so if you have other questions, I just felt like maybe this was really important because I kept giving, I knew it was important because I kept getting the question. Okay, so I have this board.
Parents with children should be sure to pick them up at 12.
Thank you. Okay. Yeah. No, we can just, you just roll it out, I think. Can you see? Okay. All right. Okay. 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 I'm sorry, I'm so, you know, you usually I get 3 hours to talk. It's hard. Hard to adjust. Okay. All right. So we're going to talk about justice. Okay? We're going to talk about it from a liberal humanist standpoint. And I would say this to them. We're going to talk about it from a critical theory, which is mostly Marxism standpoint, and then we're going to look at a Judeo-Christian worldview for this. So we're concerned about justice in schools, and so what's the analysis of injustice by these people? Okay, it's always, as I'll say here, Dallas said, it's the institution and the state that are at fault here. Institutions and people are unfair. Okay, and what we need is equality. For critical theory, it's the state, the market, and the media that create injustice. And what we need is also equality. In the Judeo-Christian thought, injustice comes from the lack of righteousness. And you can look this up in your scripture, but you will find tons of scriptures where it says righteousness and justice and righteousness are the foundations of his throne. You'll find righteousness and justice paired almost all the time. And in the Hebrew word, and I would tell my students this, in the Hebrew word for justice is the same word for righteousness. So there's a lack of righteousness, and the goal is equity. Now, this is an aside for you. The word equality only appears once in the Bible, and that's Jesus did not consider it equality with God. That's the only place equality appears. Equity is generally the word biblically. So what do we do in the and education about this. So the government here, under liberal humanism, the government creates special programs to level the playing field. This is like Head Start programs, free lunch programs, early to read programs. All of those programs are really to sort of begin to level the playing field. And it comes largely out of psychology, education, and sociology. Okay. In critical theory, what's needed is a revolution against the state. So we're not really just trying to teach a sort of self-esteem and skills here, with self-esteem always being first. That's why you have, you know, grading scales that don't work anymore. So you want a revolution against the state, and ultimately you want something like communism or socialism. And in order to get that, you must educate people to understand their state of either oppression or that they are an oppressor. Okay, that's the goal for critical theorist, is that you've got to have a revolution. You can monkey around with the system. Over here, you have to completely overthrow the system. Over here, the system is, let's just build a ladder to what already exists. Over here, they actually reject what already exists to start with. In Judeo-Christianity, you've got to educate for morality. You've got to educate a moral people who will create moral government and institutions. This is not unlike, and I would say this to them, this is not unlike what Plato's Republic was trying to do. Aristotle, Plato, all the early philosophers believed that unless you created a moral state and raised the morality of people, you couldn't have a just society. And that is still what a Judeo-Christian view of it would be. So your education would always be guided by the idea that anything you read or did or learned would lead to some kind of moral instruction. And in the process of moral instruction, you would also learn to read, write, and do mathematics. Okay, now, the first thing I did was cop out, to tell you the truth, because I taught a specifically Christian class as an elective in the summer. And I chose that because in the summers, if the class hadn't made, they wouldn't have paid me. So it's market-driven mentality, right? I'm in a private college. We're market-driven. The class either makes or it doesn't make. But then I got to thinking that there's all these graduate students going through who don't take that Christian class, where in the Christian class we actually specifically take a theory or a philosophy. Every student chooses one, and we deconstruct it through the lens of Christianity. So what are the principles that are true here? What are the principles that are false? And what true principles are missing? Those are the three questions we have in that seminar. So then I was thinking, look, we say in education we want people to be broadly educated. And so I need to show people that there is an alternative. So this is the kind of thing I try to do. And that's just a little example. You can do it with I do it with diversity. The same way, really, all you need to know about diversity is in 1 Corinthians 12. Everything is in 1 Corinthians 12. For any lecture on diversity, Martin Luther King actually put it in one sentence. He said this. You can read 1 Corinthians 12 later. For some strange reason, I can never be what I ought to be until you... I can never be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be. And you can never be what you ought to be until I am what I ought to be. This is the way God's universe is made. That comes out of one of his sermons. Okay, so there's the little, I don't know if we have time for a question or we should just, one question? A burning question. Okay.
In your presentation here, what do you choose to, is the order important to these? Did you choose that order? My first reaction was, well, geez, you know, the Christian Jews still got the
The
last slice because it was the third one. And I'm like, well, maybe you should pick that because they remember the last one.
I do it because they're least familiar with that one, I think. This is the one they most know. I mean, the order is this. I don't know that I've consciously... I know what the order is, but I don't know that I really sat and thought about it. But the order is they know this one the best. They're beginning to hear a lot about this one. And most of them have very little knowledge of this or a lot of knowledge about this, one or the other. I don't know. Maybe if you have some other comments, it would be good.
Then do you reveal what your position is or where you go from there?
Well, I think all my students know that. As one of my students said in the last class, hey, I Googled you. This is an atheist student. He's one of Michael Shermer's students, the guy who's the head of the Skeptics Society. I said, oh, yeah, what'd you find out? And he said to the class, you need to Google her. But I think it's very well known that I'm a Christian, and I would tell them, you know, if I thought they didn't know or if they ask or it's pretty clear. Yeah. Thank you. Thanks.